summarize up here at least some of the details that we went over last time for those of you who missed yesterday. I should say that all of this information you can find very nicely organized in the Particle Data Group booklets. So for example, you can find meson tables, summary tables, baryon summary tables, and then what I'm about to tell you in this lecture, which is a kind of a modern way of understanding where all of this bound state structure arises from in terms of constituent quarks. So everyone should take a look at the, say, the Particle Data Group review on this if you are ever in doubt about how this works. OK, so last time we saw that the strong interactions, the things responsible for, the forces responsible for giving rise to these bound states, respect parity. They respect charge conjugation invariance, or particle-antiparticle interchange. They respect an additive quantum number called strangeness. Additionally, the strong interactions respect a global continuous symmetry, a global SU2 continuous symmetry that we call isospin, as well as CPT. Okay. So because the strong interactions are the strongest of all, it's useful to use all of those symmetries to classify these bound states, and that's indeed what you'll find if you look at a modern classification of these, where these are just the light mesons and baryons. There's also higher mass mesons and baryons that I haven't included. Okay, but the weak interactions essentially violate all of those symmetries except CPT. And the electromagnetic interactions violate isospin, but preserve things like strangeness and parity and charge conjugation. Okay. All right, so in this lecture, I want to summarize the three-flavor quark model that we can use to understand the low-lying mesons and baryons. In principle, I could talk about the four-flavor quark model, where we add, instead of having up, down, and strange quarks, which I'll write down in a second, we add charm. There's actually two more quarks beyond those that are even heavier. But essentially, how many quarks you want to include in your constituent model depends on what sort of mass spectrum you're looking, or sort of what range of mass you're looking at. The lightest quarks are useful for understanding these, but then things like D mesons, you'll see you'll need an additional constituent. Okay, but I'll come back to that at the end. So most of these particles were discovered in the starting in the 1940s, actually, with the discovery of muons and then lambdas and kaons. And then in the 50s and 60s, we just started finding all of these states. And it was in the 1960s that Gell-Mann and others, Neumann, Zweig, others, built a model that could explain how all of these arise, at least how the spectrum can be understood in terms of constituent quarks, okay? So let me introduce those. So for light hadrons, we introduce three flavors of spin 1/2 constituent quarks. Okay? Now, I told you about isospin and strangeness, so we should assign these constituent quarks, which I'll call, everybody calls, up, down. So, up, down, and strange. And for completeness, I'll go ahead and write the other quarks. So there's a C quark, which we call charm. Okay, let me just let me put these in parentheses. Bottom, top. We're going to ignore these three for now. These three will be sufficient for understanding all the low-lying hadrons. Now, the up and the down quark, now I'm just giving you the answer. I'm not going to tell you how we would derive all of this from the data. Again, that's a course on its own. But the up and the down quark, we assign isospin 1/2. So the up and the down quark should transform as a doublet under isospin. okay? And we give the up and the down quark strangeness 0, all right? Where strangeness is this additive quantum number that the strong interactions preserve. The strange quark, on the other hand, will assign, at least for the class, for this classification of the low-lying hadrons, will assign strangeness to not transform in under isospin. And we'll give it strangeness minus 1, which just defines a strange charge. Okay. Now, let me just allude to how this is going to work out in the in basically by the end of this lecture, the beginning of next. Let me just tell you about the electromagnetic charges, which we'll be able to derive in a second. But let me just summarize them here. The up quark has an electromagnetic charge, so this is E and M charge. Of 2/3, while the down quark and the strange quark have electromagnetic charge of minus 1/3. So they'll have fractional charges. Those charge assignments will end up giving rise to all of these charges, but we'll derive that in just a second. Okay. So let's go ahead and use these constituents and see if we can build by taking symmetric flavor and spin combinations, build the mesons and the baryons out of 2 or 3 constituents here. So again, I'm just going to tell you how this works, and I'll justify it later. So we have 3 flavors here. Let's try pairing them up. So we could, now with each quark, there's going to be an anti-quark. So let's take quark-anti-quark pairs. So let's take, okay. So for these, there's 9 states in principle. So at least we can account, well, we can at least account for the fact that there's 9 sets of states in the meson families, the nonets. If we identify mesons with QQ bar bound states, where Q is, so QI is up, down, strange. Now, we notice that the mesons come in pseudoscalar and vector meson families. How do we understand that? Well, there may be 9 flavor configurations, but there's 2 times 2, 4, which is 0 plus 3, sorry, 1 plus 3 spin configurations. Why do I write it like that? Well, if you have spin 1/2 aligned, that gives you a spin 1 configuration, plus or minus 1. And then there's 2 combinations of the spins being anti-aligned in a symmetric and anti-symmetric combination. Those give you 2 spin 0 contributions. So 2 spin 1/2 constituents can give rise to a bound state where either it's in a spin 1 configuration or it's in a spin 0 configuration. Okay, so there's, along the z direction, say you have spin minus 1, 0, and 1. That's 3 degrees of freedom. And then you have a spin 0 configuration in this scalar mode here. So we see if you have QQ bar bound states where those quarks are spin 1/2, we can roughly account for the fact that there's a grouping of 9 that are scalars, and there's a grouping of 9 that are vectors. OK? So this implies 9 scalars. Not scalars, pseudoscalars, but we'll get to that in a second. Plus 9 vectors. Okay. Now, the scalar configuration, I believe this is even a problem, if I'm not mistaken, on the problem set in tutorial today. Tutorial's today, right? No? Later? OK, well, anyway, there's a tutorial problem set that'll ask you about the parity assignment of quark-anti-quark bound states in an S-wave configuration. And you'll find that the parity of those bound states are minus 1. So if we have an S-wave QQ bar bound state that gives rise to a scalar mode, it has parity minus 1. So we say that that these states are actually pseudoscalars. Okay, and that's what we found. Well, that's what I told you last time, at least. Okay, now likewise, for the same flavor QQ bar configurations, you can derive that those should have charge conjugation assignments of +1 for spin 0, and they should have -1 for spin 1. And again, this is in the tutorial problem set. Okay. So I'll just write that here. So same flavor, QQ bar has C equals +1 for spin 0, C equals -1 for spin 1. Okay. And this you can derive just using CPT properties of fermion wave functions, and then looking at the transformation properties of the bound states themselves. Okay. All right, so let's go about assigning quarks to these different constituents. We have now this picture that the QQ bar bound states of these three flavors can account for the structure of mesons. There's also baryons. But before we get to baryons, there's one regularity that you should notice. I didn't write the masses out here, but you can either look at the PDG tables or you can look at the notes from the last lecture. I wrote them out there. If you look at the vector mesons, and also this is true of the baryons as well, but there's a certain mass hierarchy. So for example, the mass of the phi and the mass of the K stars here, this is roughly 100, you know, it's roughly 110 to 120 MeV, depending on which one you look at. Also, if you look at the mass difference of the K stars and the omegas and the rows, these are very close in mass. You find that's also about 120 MeV. And in particular, the phi is the heaviest meson. Okay. So it turns out that these constituent quarks, they have their own masses. And the strange quark is the heaviest of them. Okay. So if you want to account for the rough hierarchy of vector mesons, you want to identify the phi state as the state that's mostly SS bar. It turns out to be almost entirely dominated by the strange quark wave function. Okay. So phi is mostly SS bar. Okay. And it'll turn out that that these kaons, well, we'll get to this in a second. I'll go through it systematically in a bit. Okay. I should have written this over there so you can move them on your notes. But I'm going to start with baryons over here. Okay. Now the baryons also have a roughly equal spacing. Certainly the spin 3 halved ones do in particular. So it also appears that there's a mass hierarchy in the up and down quarks versus the strange quark. And essentially, as you go from the deltas to the sigmas to the xis to the omegas, you're adding strange quark content as you go down. And that can account for the rough mass hierarchy. Okay, and it also accounts for the additive quantum number assignments of these baryons. But baryons turn out to be products of three constituent quarks, okay? So baryons are essentially groups of three. Okay. And they are symmetric combinations in flavor and spin space. Okay, well, how does that counting work? So note that we have three flavors here. Each flavor has two spin degrees of freedom. So there's a total of six flavor spin degrees of freedom. Okay, so six flavor spin degrees of freedom. And if you count the number of fully symmetric combinations of three objects that have six configurations, there should be a total of six times, this is just Hooke's rule. There should be 56 combinations. Okay. Now I'll write this as 2 times 8 plus 4 times 10. Why do I do that? Because whereas the mesons come in these nonets, or groups of 9, the baryons appear to group up into an octet and then a group of 10. Okay? But the octet has spin 1/2, so each one of those mesons has two spin degrees of freedom. Whereas each one of these baryons has two spin degrees of freedom. Whereas this group of 10 here has a spin 3/2. So each baryon here has 4 spin degrees of freedom. Spin 3/2, 1/2, minus 1/2, minus 3/2. Okay? So fully symmetric in flavor spin space combinations of three quarks here can account at least for at the degree of freedom level that structure. This is the octet and the decouplet. Okay. Now, how do we make the quark assignments? Well, first let's start with the same flavor quarks assignments. Okay, so I'll just write this board here. Okay, so what about the heavy quark? What about three S's? Now note, by the way, that I'm totally ignoring Fermi statistics when I talk about the symmetrization properties of the wave functions. That'll turn out to be important later on. Right now, I'm making the ansatz that the wave functions are fully symmetric in flavor spin space. But if you think for a second, if they're built out of fermions, that shouldn't make a lot of sense. That should, in fact, look wrong. But we'll come back to that. Okay, so what about an SSS configuration? Well, if we identify this with the heaviest baryon, and given our strangeness assignment, the only baryon here that has strangeness minus 3 is the omega, so we should identify the omega here with the triple S configuration. Okay. Now, by the way, I haven't given S an isospin assignment here, so it's okay. So this omega doesn't have to transform in an isospin configuration. But what about other configurations that have, say, UUU? These should certainly transform under isospin. I've given the up and down quarks isospin assignments. Also, DDD. Okay. Now you should be able to guess roughly where these live, which ones these can account for. Does anybody know what the triple U or triple D would have? You can sort of guess it by taking products of isospin 1/2. I told you that the up and down quarks are an isospin 1/2. So if I take three products of objects that have isospin 1/2, the highest weight one is going to live in an isospin 3/2 grouping. Okay? So these are going to live in the deltas. So this is basically the delta plus plus. I like to think about it as this is one way of deriving the charge. But in particular, if you identify the omega minus with the triple S, then we say that then that's one way to identify the electromagnetic charge of the S. And if we go ahead and we identify using isospin here, if we identify three products with the isospin three halves guy, I could have just derived the charge from this assignment. That's sort of the way I prefer to think about it. Okay, so this is the delta minus. Okay. Now, these are the fully symmetric spin-aligned combinations. So you can see how these all have spin three halves, right? Now, that's a good question, but at least the way I am doing this is I am using this identification to justify the charges I wrote down before here of plus 2/3 for the electromagnetic charge of the up quark and minus 1/3 for the down and the strange. Okay? All right, what about all the others? I need to clear up some board space here. Okay, so let's go through the S. Let's go through the strangeness minus one states, the strangeness minus two states, and then we can guess the rough assignments of all the others. I'll go back to the mesons after I finish this. So S equals minus one states. Okay. So we can have two ups and a strange. Right, we can have an up and a down and a strange here. We can have two downs and a strange. Right. Now, there are several ways of seeing what these should be identified with. But remember, up and down live in an isospin doublet. Right. So what this you should think of this state as a state that comes from a product of two isospin a half representations. So living inside there is an isospin one representation. Okay. Because this is fully symmetric, you're not going to get the isospin zero part, okay? So you should identify these with an isospin one baryon that has strangeness minus one, right? Because there's one strange quark in there. So that's the sigmas, okay? And the difference, whether or not the spins are all aligned or anti-aligned, or some of them are anti-aligned, will tell you whether or not it's sigma or sigma star. So in particular, this is the sigma plus, sigma zero, sigma minus. Now I'm not actually writing out the wave functions in detail. I'm actually just specifying the quark content when I write this down. So I'll put a squiggly here. But in practice, you have to appropriately symmetrize the wave function in their flavor and spin indices. Okay. So this belongs to an I equals one multiplet. And this comes from the fact that if you take the 1/2 direct product with the half, what I really wanted to say is that the one lives inside half of the half, and the fully symmetric combination is the one. Now, what about the S equals two configurations? So that's just one strange quark, so we could put two strange quarks in. Okay. So, for example, we can put, let's put in two strange quarks in an up, or we could put in two strange quarks in a down. Now, this has just got one quark that transforms non-trivially under isospin. Okay, so this object should live in an isospin doublet, isospin a half. It has strangeness minus two. So which baryons are these? So these are the Xi's, okay? And whether or not their spins are appropriately aligned or anti-aligned will tell you whether or not they're spin a half or spin three halves. Okay, so this is the minus state. This is the zero state. Now, let's see. So I think we've covered, right. So which ones have I left out? I've left out a bunch of them. I haven't told you what the quark content of the kaons versus the rows are. I can do that. So the kaons have strangeness plus or minus 1. So you would naively guess these are just, and they live in isospin doublet states. So kaons have an up or a down quark and then a strange quark in them, right? And the others, the pions, the rows, and the etas, the omega and the phi, their combinations, well, their not these two, but these, the pies and the rows are QQ bar states that involve just up and down quarks. Okay. So is that clear? Or I can write this out in a bit more detail, but I'll just summarize here. So let's do the S equals minus 1 mesons. So if we have things like, we can have things like upstrange. We have things like, strange bar. Downstrange bar. Right, so remember this is plus a third, this is 2/3, so these are charged, this is a charge plus 1 state. That's a charge 0 state. It has strangeness plus 1. Good, so I got it right. So this is the K plus, this is the K 0. Right? Alternatively, then I could look at SU bar and SD bar, and those would be the conjugate states. That would account for the K bar 0 and the K minus. Okay? So I could look at the U bar S, D bar S, that'd be the K minus and the K zero bar. Now the pions and the rows actually have, you could see, if you could take a UD bar has charge plus 1, right? So that those are the pi plus, the UU bar, DD bar states, there's combinations of them give you pi 0. And again, whether or not the spins are aligned or anti-aligned tells you whether you're a pion or a row. Okay, so all of these light mesons and baryons can be accounted for in this picture. Okay, but there's a couple of very mysterious things about the way I've set this up. So first of all, we've been accounting for all of this structure by assuming that the wave functions, are all symmetric in flavor and spin space. Okay, but the constituents are fermions. So when you take, collections of fermions, the wave functions are supposed to anti-commute when you interchange them, right? And yet we've been accounting for this using symmetric combinations. All right, so that's a little weird. Now, in fact, this was used as a motivation for introducing an additional quantum number that could be, that when introduced would allow you to fully anti-symmetrize the wave functions and account for the constituents being spin 1/2, okay? So a number of folks introduced color, okay? So basically, let's just say there's a conflict between apparent symmetrization of flavor and spin. Degrees of freedom, and spin 1/2 statistics, or Fermi statistics. Let's put the Fermi there. Okay. So one way to get around this is to introduce a new quantum number, which we'll call color. Okay. And when we do that, I'll do that in just a second. So that's one oddity with this model. Another oddity with this model is that we don't ever see quarks by themselves. Okay, this is, I'm sure, I think everybody knows this. But Normally when you, well, at least if you take QED as any indicator, when you try to build atoms out of constituents, you can usually knock the constituents out. Okay, well, when these constituents were introduced, there was this kind of irritation that nobody had ever seen the constituents in isolation. Okay, so there's some other amazing property here of the strong interactions that that the constituents that give rise to these bound states or can explain these bound states, they're all confined. Okay. Now, we'll be able to understand this, at least heuristically, as a property of the strong interactions arising from a non-abelian gauge theory. Okay. And I think in the first two quantum field theory courses, did all of you cover asymptotically free gauge theories, or were gauge theories discussed? That's a yes? Okay. Don't worry, I'll review it in a little bit of detail, but for now we'll just move on. Okay. Now, so how do we actually assign color then to these quarks so that we can anti-symmetrize them? Well, we say, so let's do, this is the color assignment. We say that each flavor has essentially three colors. Okay. So whereas I was writing, I had a QI, where this was up, down, strange in this case, QI should also have some other index, which I'll call A here. Okay. Where A is sort of 1, 2, 3. Okay, so there's three colors for these quarks. Now it turns out you can heuristically justify why you only see these combinations, why you only see combinations of quarks that give rise to these mesons and baryons, if you say that the quarks transform under this color quantum number like they're in the fundamental of SU3. So you assume that these three colors of quarks actually realize a big global symmetry. Okay. And then you demand that the bound states are singlets under that symmetry. And you'll find that when you do that, you can only have mesons or baryons. You can't have other combinations of quarks. Okay. So essentially, the QI transform under a big SU3 color symmetry. Okay. The SU3 acts on the A index here that I wrote up here. Okay, and so the Qs transform as a 3 of SU3. Okay, and the Q bars transform as the in the conjugate representation of SU3. Now you may recall from your group theory how to build singlet states that are totally invariant under these SU3 transformations. And if we ask, well, how do you do that? We want all of these bound states to be singlets under this SU3 global symmetry. So then where can they come from? Well, there's essentially two different, well, three, but two of them are related by conjugation. But there's two different ways of building these invariants. You can either use delta AB, or you can use epsilon ABC. Let me write up the lower index. Okay. You can use these two tensors to contract objects in the fundamental of SU3 to build invariants. Okay. And that's the only thing you can do. Yeah.
That question in the other notation is I the color index and
no, I is the flavor index in this notation.
So that's U3 should act on the color index, right?
Yes.
Well, you have, yeah, but you have acts on the I index.
No.
Is that
that's a
oh A.
Sorry. This is probably bad notation. It's probably also not standard. Okay, so these give rise to mesons. Contraction, okay, this what this does is this object contracts a fundamental with an anti-fundamental to give a singlet. This gives us our mesons, right? So you get mesons out of this. And this needs to take three fundamentals. There's another tensor that you can use, which is the upper index guy. So this takes, so this we'll call these baryons. And we'll call these anti-baryons. So these take three fundamentals, and these take three anti-fundamentals. Okay, so it tells you there's essentially two qualitatively different ways of getting singlets. And so if you demand that the physics, that the long-distance physics only sees these color singlets, then you can explain why you only have mesons and baryons built out of these constituents. Now, there's actually some exotic baryon states that we can imagine constructing, which involve groupings of these two that have more than two or three. These are so-called pentachoric states. But we won't get into that. Okay. Okay. Now, a couple of things I haven't mentioned that maybe we'll come back to later is that these aren't the only mesons and baryons that we see, obviously. There are more quarks. I mentioned earlier that we have charm quarks, bottom quarks, top quarks. Now, the charm quark, when you include it, you get a somewhat larger family of mesons and hadrons. You can take a look at the PDG review to give you an idea for how that works. The D mesons, for example, are the mesons that carry charm quarks in them. You also have J psi as well, which is like a CC bar bound state. There's also bottom mesons, okay? Those include bottom quarks. And so far, we haven't managed to make mesons or baryons that have top quarks in them as sort of well-defined bound states. And that's in part because the top quark is heavier than anything else in the standard model. Okay, it's the heaviest object that we have in the standard model. It's roughly 180 GeV. Okay, it's twice the mass of the W and the Z. And it decays really fast. Okay, so this is all I'm going to say about the quark model for now. But now I want to go on and explain where this comes from. Because I haven't told you anything about where the strong interactions come from, where the weak interactions come from, or electromagnetism. I've certainly given you some idea for how the strong interactions are going to come about. I've told you about color, and as you all know, probably you've heard before, the strong interactions are a gauge theory that gauges this color quantum number. Okay. So let's move on. And in the remainder of this lecture, I'm going to start my summary of the standard model field theory. Okay, so now we're going to get into field theory. And after I tell you about the standard model field theory, I'm going to take us on a little bit of a detour and explain why you should even expect that the standard model is a field theory. That's a perfectly legitimate question to ask. I can just tell you it is a field theory, but you should ask why. Okay. So part of the reason I've been telling you about all of these low-lying mesons and baryons and the particles of the standard model is that this is what you see in nature. Okay, we know that these things exist, and we think that they interact in a way that exhibits relativistic invariance. So you should ask the question, well, when you try to build a quantum mechanical theory with particles in it that's relativistically invariant, what kind of theory is that? What does it look like? And why is it a field theory? Okay, or why does it look like a field theory? So I want you to have some idea for why the standard model is a field theory, given that the building blocks are particles, leptons, quarks, mesons, and baryons. Okay, but I really should give you the answer first. So let's get started on the standard model field theory. Keep this around. Now, a few preliminary remarks are in order. There's four fundamental forces as far as we can tell. There may be more, right? There's gravity. There's electromagnetism. These survive at long distances. Then there's the strong forces. These turn out to confine, but they're mediated by massless gluons, as far as we can tell. And then there's the weak interactions, which are mediated by massive vector mesons, the W and the Z. Okay. Now, I'm going to focus on the field theory for the weak, strong, and electromagnetic interactions. Within the standard model, we can treat gravity as an effective quantum field theory. And we can even compute leading order quantum effects, and that's fine. You get totally reasonable, physical, well-defined, consistent answers in the weak gravitational limit. Okay? And then we run into all sorts of problems when we approach strong gravity. Okay? So I'm going to set aside gravity. I may come back to it a little bit later and justify gravity as the theory that you get whenever you have massless spin 2 particles around. Okay? GR is basically forced on you as soon as you say those words. But for now, we're going to ignore it. Okay? Now, I'm also going to ignore things that we know exist outside of the standard model proper. So I'm going to ignore dark energy, as this is sort of a, you know, when you look at the universe, most of the energy density in the universe is not made up of familiar stuff. There's probably a cosmological constant that counts for that. That's fine. More pressing for the standard model is it looks like there's particle-like material out there that accounts for the bulk of the matter density in the universe. We call this dark matter. We don't know where that comes from, okay? Eventually, we'll call it part of the standard model, but right now, it's a big open question. It's most of the matter in the universe, but despite that, I'm going to ignore it, and we're just going to focus on the few percent of the universe that that we can identify as belonging to these states. All right? There's a few other things. I'm going to gloss over neutrino masses. This is a very active research area right now, but at least in this course, we may come back to it at the very end, but I'm going to treat it as a somewhat more advanced topic. Okay. Okay, so what does the standard model by this definition encompass? So there's essentially two length scales that we should have in mind here, where the standard model lives. So on the one hand, we have 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, which is the scale where weak interactions become strong. Actually, you have to go a little bit further than 10 to the, a little bit smaller than 10 to the minus 16 centimeters for that to happen. Okay, but then as far as we can tell, and admittedly, you know, this is not, you know, it's not rock solid truth because we haven't done exhaustive tests at scales much larger than laboratory scale. But the standard model appears valid roughly out to about 10 to the 30 centimeters size of the universe. Okay. So over this ridiculous scale of lengths, all the phenomenon we've seen, all the phenomenon we've probed, they appear to be described by the standard model that I'm about to summarize for you. Okay. All right. Feel free to ask me separately about the history of all this. It's a fascinating story, but I think it would take us on too much of a detour in this class. So I want to break up the Lagrangian of the standard model into three pieces. So we'll have a force piece. We'll have a matter piece. And these parts we actually understand reasonably well. And then what we don't understand so well, we have a lot of information about it. It's what I'll call the mass piece. It's where all the masses in the standard model come from. Okay. So the theory of the standard model forces and the matter content is extremely predictive and relatively well understood, except at low energy where it becomes strongly coupled, and then we have to use phenomenological theories to explain nuclear reactions and things like that. But this part's well understood. This part we know a lot about. Most of the free parameters of the standard model are here. All these masses, and there's the masses span orders of magnitude. You got some flavor of that when I told you about leptons and quarks in the first lecture. But also, some of the quarks actually mix among themselves, and there's parameters that control that. it turns out that the weak interactions violate CP, okay, and there's parameters that control that. So the messy stuff in the standard model lives here. And this is also the part that gives rise to, that prevents us from extrapolating the low energy standard model to high energies without invoking the Higgs mechanism. And I'll tell you about that. And that's essentially the thing that we're studying now at the LHC. Because we're trying to understand how to extend the standard model to scales smaller than this energy scale. Okay? But the problems that you encounter at this energy scale and a little bit smaller all essentially arise from this piece. Okay. Okay. Okay, now the next, I think, 20 minutes or so, there's gonna be a lot of writing here. All right, so the force Lagrangian, just bear with me, we're gonna have to establish some common notation. So I'm about to do a lot of writing. And I won't finish this lecture, but hopefully within 10 minutes of the next lecture I'll finish and then we can continue. But so first we have the strong interactions, which are characterized by an SU3 gauge theory. So I'll write the field strength in the following way. Okay, so this is SU3 Yang-Mills. Okay, A is SU3 adjoint index. You may recall that in gauge theories, the fundamental massless vectors, they transform under the gauged symmetry group in the adjoint. Okay, the adjoint of SU3 has 8 objects in it. Okay, so this is the strong part. Then we have an SU2 cross U1 structure. The U1 is not the U1 of electromagnetism. That comes later. Okay, I apologize. I'm about to switch my index convention so that the early lowercase alphabet's going to refer to SU2, but sorry. This is the SU2, Yang-Mills. This is U1. Now there's 3 gauge couplings, G1, G2, G3, that I wrote up here. I'm putting them in the kinetic terms for now. So when you see me write covariant derivatives in a second, the gauge coupling won't be living there because I put it over here. Okay, so there's only 3 parameters, and these parameters you should naturally think of after renormalization as running parameters. Okay, they run with scale. But those 3 completely specify at least the structure of the standard model forces, at least the free part. But they also determine the nature of the couplings with the matter fields that I'll introduce. So we have the SU3 strong, we have the SU2 weak. Well, I really shouldn't. This is really weak in a very loose sense. I should really call the SU2 cross U1 part here, this whole thing, as electroweak. And that's because you'll see that the photon actually arises as a linear combination of this U1 with the U1 that lives inside the SU2 here. Okay? We have to break electroweak symmetry first. Now, the field strengths here. So you may have seen this before, B mu is just the field strength constructed out of a vector potential B. Okay. So that's the field strength. Now, for the abelian field strength, it's just this. I'm not sure if you've seen this, but for non-abelian field strengths, when you introduce a vector potential, you introduce a vector potential A, which carries this index A, sorry, okay. And then the field strength that you build out of this has a piece that looks just like the thing you find in the abelian case. But then it has a piece that's controlled by the non-abelian structure constants, okay? And again, A, B, C, this runs from 1 to 8. Okay, and the F, A, B, C are the SU3 structure constants. similarly for SU2, SU2 takes a similar form where instead of the FABC being structure constants for SU3, they're the structure constants for SU2. But I'm not going to write that. Now, I'm not sure how much you've studied gauge theories, so I want to just, you know, in 5 minutes, just crash through all of the basic ingredients, at least classical gauge theories. Oops. That wasn't nice of me. I shouldn't hide that. There we go. Okay. Okay, so just a quick refresher. So the symmetry group, all of these gauge theories make reference to some underlying symmetry group. I'll explain a little bit later this week why that's always the case. You can understand that from the bottom on up. If you just ask, what does a theory look like when you have more than one massless vector particle that interacts? You find that they can only interact consistently if they interact with one another in a way that realizes a symmetry of one form or another like this. Okay? But so the symmetry groups have a Lie algebra structure. Okay, so for example, we say that if we parameterize the group with some set of parameters omega, so this really you should think of as some vector here when I write it. We can write this as an exponentiated, so we have some index here, right, as A. Okay, so this is a parameter. This is a group generator. I think you've seen this in the review of Lie algebras and Lie groups earlier last year. Okay. But the structure of the group can be characterized by motions near the origin. All right, and that structure is characterized by the commutator of these group elements. And this is how the structure constants arise. And what we do when we build gauge theories is we try to build a theory where the matter content and the vectors transform under a local version of the symmetry group. Basically, we want the theory to be invariant under transformations that can be different, can be functions of space and time. At least that's one way to understand how to build gauge theories. So, for example, Let's see, what do I need to tell you? So couplings of gauge fields and gauge fields sometimes when I write A of mu of x, this will be shorthand for essentially, I can take my, in the case of SU3, 8 vector fields, and out of each one I can construct a matrix that lives in this group space, right? And I can construct a matrix valued field strength, okay? So sometimes you'll see me write this. Okay, and what we normally do is we introduce couplings to these gauge fields through a covariant derivative. So this is the gauge field. Couplings of gauge field, so to matter, occur through covariant derivatives. Okay. I can write on the back of this one. Now, note while that's, so here's the reason why covariant derivatives are useful. So with the vector potential defined in that fashion, gauge transformations take the following form. Okay, where U is just some position dependent, I'm doing this all for SU3, okay, but you can, this is true for SU3, you know, or SU2, etc. Transformation matrix. Okay. And so under this transformation, the covariant derivative just goes to U d mu U dagger. So the covariant derivative has nice transformations. The field strength that I was writing earlier, or rather the complete field strengths, you can just, those are just commutators of these covariant derivative operators. And these transform under gauge transformations nicely as well. Okay? So the reason it's useful to introduce covariant derivatives and field strengths that have these nice transformation properties is that then you can build invariants. As, for example, you can take trace F squared, right? This is just shorthand for contracting the Lorentz indices mu and nu. Okay, so let me just, this is trace, and I'll write it out explicitly. Okay, so F mu nu A, F mu nu A. This is just the same thing as taking the trace of the field strength viewed as a matrix. Okay, and you see that under gauge transformations, this will be invariant, right? Because this will just go to trace FF U dagger, which is trace FF, okay? Because this is some unitary transformation, all right? Likewise, okay, good. Just one more piece here. Likewise, the covariant derivative, given its nice transformation properties, can be used easily to build invariants. So for example, ordinarily, if you have, say, a matter field, so let's say we introduce a fermion field. So a kinetic term would look like, say, psi dagger sigma mu del nu psi, or these are just Pauli matrices. Okay. Now, we want to introduce couplings between these gauge fields and the fermion fields in a way that is fully invariant when we apply these local transformations. The local transformations act this way on the gauge fields, and they just act like so on, in this case, fermion matter fields. Okay, so now the way you should view this is psi now should be thought of as some object that carries a group index. Okay, so you know, let's say some psi. In the case of quarks, we had three color quantum numbers, right? So there'd be some psi 1, psi 2, psi 3 here, right? So it'd be a fundamental of SU3, and then this U matrix is just the group transformation matrix that I have over here, but acting on a row 3 vector, okay? Or sorry, a column 3 vector. Now the reason this is this transformation, if this were just a global transformation that did not depend on space-time at all, then the kinetic term here would be invariant. If I elevate this to, I can include the indices here. But the problem here is that if I take a position-dependent transformation, right, I can then look at U psi transform. Right, this is not going to be the same thing as psi dagger. Right, that's not going to be invariant under a transformation where you transform the matter fields in the fundamental. What would be invariant is the same object where you replace the derivative with the covariant derivative. Okay, the covariant derivative has nice simple transformation properties. So now when we apply this U matrix to psi, we also have to transform the D matrix, okay? Okay. So I'm doing this a little bit quick, and maybe I'll come back to some of these points at the beginning of the next lecture. But if instead of using just ordinary derivatives, I use this covariant derivative in the kinetic terms for the fermion fields, and there's an analogous statement here for charged scalar fields, then under local transformations, the kinetic terms will remain invariant here. Okay? And essentially, the way you could think about this is the covariant derivative, when you transform it, it picks up a UU dagger. Okay? You get a U dagger here, which cancels the U that you get here, and you get a U here that cancels the U dagger on the right-hand side. So the whole thing remains invariant. So essentially, the shorthand procedure for for coupling gauge fields to matter fields is to introduce a covariant derivative in the kinetic term. Okay. And that's going to lead us to the matter part of the Lagrangian that I wrote down earlier, but I think I should stop now. We're running over time. So let me see if there's any questions. I'm going to come back and review some of this at the beginning of next lecture. I think I went through this a little too quickly, especially if you haven't seen it before. But can I just take a quick poll? In the earlier field theory courses, did you go over this setup of gauge theories, non-abelian gauge theories? Just can you raise your hands if you've seen this before? OK, good. All right, are there any questions? Great. Okay, so next time then I'll finish introducing the matter part of the Lagrangian and the standard model. So I have to tell you what all the matter content is. Then I'll start telling you about where all of the masses in the standard model come from. I'll tell you about the Yukawa sector, and I'll tell you what we think the minimal Higgs sector looks like. Okay? But at that point, I want to take a small detour in the latter part of this week and just try to understand field theory as a theory of interacting particles that respect unitarity and Lorentz invariance. The reason I think it's important to go through this is that one of the best ways to understand the standard model and one of the best ways to study beyond the standard model physics and to study natural phenomena in general is to not think of field theories as fundamental, you know, as sort of the final, you know, the kind of the final setup that you're going to have. But you should think of field theories as the thing that you typically get whenever you have interacting particles. Okay? So you can take any system that you want. It's got particles, it respects Lorentz invariance, it respects the laws of quantum mechanics. What you'll always find is there'll be some field theory description of that system, okay? And that field theory will have some range of validity, okay? It'll be what we call an effective field theory. And if you understand that, it'll make a lot more sense to you why, for example, it's useful to study the QCD or strong interaction part of the standard model using an effective field theory that involves just pions, for example, that exhibit chiral symmetry, because there's chiral symmetries in the standard model. You'll understand why at very, very low energies, it's sufficient just to look at, say, the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian as an effective field theory of QED below the electron mass. And you'll understand why it's totally reasonable that the theory that describes the weak interactions is the Fermi model at low energies. There'll be some, you know, of course, the details matter. There's, you know, more than one kind of theory you can build. But it'll always look like an effective field theory up to some energy scale. And then depending on whether or not the theory is renormalizable or not, you may or may not be able to continue using that theory to arbitrary high energies. Okay? But the main point is that once you understand that field theories are the things that you get from interacting particles in a Lorentz invariant way in quantum mechanics, then effective field theories should make a lot more sense to you as the thing to work with and the thing to think about when you're understanding different sectors of the standard model and when you're thinking about beyond the standard model physics. Okay? So I'll stop there and we'll continue with this next time.